Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you this week from the New York campus of Cheung Kong Graduate School of Business, CKGSB. Let's hear you folks make a little noise. The Seneca Podcast is produced in partnership with SupChina, of course. SupChina is the best way to stay on top of the most important news from China in just a few minutes a day with our free daily email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, and at our website, supchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo. I am joined, of course, by Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn, whose hirsute countenance has consistently defeated even the most sophisticated Chinese selfie beautification apps. But we love him anyway. And so does his wife, Faye, by the way, whose lovely face cannot be possibly improved by said selfie beautification app. So, Jeremy, please greet our audience both here and at home, won't you?
Hi, everyone. Well, what do you want from my wife, Kaiser?
That I cannot say on the air.
I'm delighted to be here in New York and at CKGSB. And I have a long history, actually, with CKGSB. I did a lot of work for them in Beijing, sort of writing. And we organized some events, actually, speaking events, yes, similar to this one. So this feels like a bizarro version of Beijing.
Yeah, actually, I think I was on one of those events that you did at CKGSB. That was fun, right. Yeah. Anyway, it's easy when you were watching China from the U.S. for your focus to fall mainly on the politics and the economics of the country. As important as these two facets of China naturally are, it is crucial that we don't focus too much on them to the exclusion of what's happening in society and in culture. We believe that a truly holistic approach has always been necessary for anyone wanting to wrap their heads around what's happening in China. China has, after all, undergone such incredibly rapid change, compressing really the whole experience that the West has taken multiple generations, maybe even a century, into just the span of a few decades. The impact of rapid urbanization, of a sexual revolution, of sudden affluence, of a massive man-made demographic skew, and of an explosion of technology is something that hasn't been written about enough for China and probably never can be. And so today on our show, we are absolutely thrilled to be joined by our dear friend Jiayang Fan, who is staff writer for The New Yorker and who, are by our lights, has been writing some of the very best pieces on contemporary Chinese society that we have seen.
Jiayang has been a guest on the show before, and more importantly, just recently, she starred in the pilot episode of SupChina's new cooking show.
Yeah. I hope you've all seen that.
My true claim to fame.
Yes, your true claim to fame.
Your true claim to fame. The show is called The Secret Menu, and Jiayang showed us how to make hot and spicy shredded potatoes. Jiayang, we're really happy to have you back.
I'm very glad to be here.
So Jiayang, we want to talk to you today about a couple of standout pieces that you've written just in this year, both of them for The New Yorker, of course, both of them reported from on the ground in China, and both of them about facets of social change in China. So back in June, you published an amazing story about mistress dispellers, people working in a rather strange industry aimed at preserving marriages by driving off the home wreckers, the xiaosan, the mistresses. But more than that, it's a fascinating exploration of the whole institution of marriage in China and how it has evolved and come under massive pressure during China's tumultuous changes since reform and opening began. So that's one of the pieces that we want to talk to you about. The other is a very recent piece about China that looks at selfie beautification apps like the ones that Jeremy has broken many of their faces. Now, these are selfie-optimized smartphones, you know, with cameras that like automatically beautify your face, supposedly beautify your face. The phenomenon of Wang Hong, also of these internet celebrities, of live streaming, and the strange world surrounding this company called Meitu and its technology, the technologies that have enabled a culture of abject narcissism in China. It's really, I mean, by my lights, just kind of horrifying. More than that, though, this piece is a meditation on changing values, on generational change. We encourage you all to read both of these stories if you haven't already. They both give you an awful lot to think about.
So, Jiang, let's start with Meitu. First of all, why don't you tell us about this company and its products, the phones, the apps, the video site, and maybe a brief history of the company's short life. And how did you get interested in writing about this company?
All right. So I first experienced Meitu through the phones of friends, or actually, you know, backing up, I first began seeing on my Instagram these rather blurred, sort of fantastic looking faces of friends, and there was a very strange flawlessness to their quality. Like, you couldn't pick out one feature that was wrong with their face, but when you saw the picture, you realized that it didn't look like something that you would just take with the native camera on my phone. So I wondered at first if all of China had just gotten plastic surgery in the few months that I have been living in the U.S. and was confused for some time. But when a friend pointed me to this app, I began to see how pervasive and influential it had become and how interlinked it has become to the culture of influencers and internet celebrities. So I started looking at the company. It started in 2008, I believe, and it didn't really gain traction until 2011, I think, when it moved to a mobile platform. And that's when, you know, everyone ages, I think, 12 to, I want to say, 52 began using it. And it has just become, I think, nothing short of a cultural phenomenon. I mean, no one now, as I've been told, really can fathom posting a picture on social media without Meituing or, you know, peeing, for P short is short photoshopping. In English, it doesn't quite work as well.
I know, do anything before peeing.
But you got to pee on your photographs
right,
first.
Right. You got to pee on your face first, exactly. But in Chinese, it has become such a prominent part of social media. And I visited the company earlier this year in June, actually. And it's located in Xiamen, which is, by Chinese standards, a relatively small city. But it's along the coast, and it has developed rapidly in recent years. And the company is surprisingly young. I think the average age is mid-20s. And really got us, I spent, you know, a little over a week there, and I really got a sense of how this company kind of worked inside and out. And the kind of beauty I experienced there is, I don't know if you guys have ever been to a perfume shop, and it just, you walk in and it just hits you. And there's so many different kinds, and it's so pungent that you can't tell if everything is supposed to smell extraordinary. Extraordinarily good or terribly, terribly bad. And walking in, I mean, the employees are attractive. Everything is in kind of these pastel shades. It looks like you're supposed to be having a good time and experiencing the beauty of the place. But you can't help but kind of doubt your perceptions and experience every moment of the way. Or at least that was my
experience.
So
they make these apps. They also make phones, right?
Right. They also so I was given a tour on my first day. They do they make a battery of apps. I think about five of them are most popular. Beauty Plus, Makeup Plus, Beauty Camera, Selfie City are some of the names, and they give you an idea of what they're used for. But most of its revenue at this point actually comes from its phones. I think it makes up for, you know, an overwhelming percentage of its revenue. And these phones are designed to allow you to take extraordinarily enhanced selfies, and they are massively popular with the Chinese population.
And are people buying two phones or Or are they using the Meitu phone as their main
phone? I think they save up for the Meitu phone. I think they might start with kind of what, you know, we have, you know, the
cheap Apple phone.
Right, exactly.
Apple 7 or 8, right.
But I think I was in a Meitu store in Xiamen, and I was there when a few women walked in, and you should have just seen their faces. I mean, these were two young mothers who actually came in with their strollers, and they said, I can't believe I have never discovered this before. This is absolutely life-changing. And these are not, you know, cheap phones. But they immediately said, well, this is, you know, I know what I'm going to be asking my husband for this.
Wow.
During the holiday season.
So one of the things this has enabled, or it has played a part in, is live streaming. Okay. And you talk about this quite a bit in your article. Could you tell us a little bit about the people who make money as live streaming celebrities? People like Honey CC, who's featured in your piece.
Right. I mean, the live streaming culture in China has grown so swiftly and extraordinarily in the past few years. And I think it's important to point out that it is pervasive throughout the culture, but that there are also different tiers of live streaming. Meipei is part of Meitu. It's one of the products, and it is a live streaming platform. It's supposed to be sort of this hybrid between, I want to say, kind of Instagram and Facebook, where you just upload your short videos, but you can also stream on there. Honey CC is actually one of the more culturally sophisticated of these live streamers.
Oh, God.
Just for those who haven't read my piece, I start my article by talking about Honey CC, who is this 27-year-old web celebrity. But there are other platforms like Kuaishou that really live stream bizarre, absurd, very sensational, Jackass-esque videos. I mean, you know, over the, I think, past few months, two of the most popular ones are stuffing firecrackers down your underwear for a young man.
Oh, yeah.
he live streams this and just exploded on the web.
And, literally.
And also wasabi eating contests.
Oh, God.
And you can imagine how that might unfurl. But that is one spectrum of the live streaming platform. And then overwhelmingly there's a breed of, you know, very attractive women who really are just coquettish in front of a camera, and that can go on for hours, sometimes days. And usually it works by the live streamers earn money when you in real time shower them with monetary donations, gifts that kind of pop up from the bottom that spring up from their phone, you know, every time you kind of give them money, or, you know, in the form of, you know, tiny emoticons of bouquets of flowers and coins. And you get to ask questions, I think, when you give money. And it has just become immensely popular with Chinese youth.
Right. This is the inspiration for our new paid Slack channel, right, Jeremy?
We're going to have you dancing coquettishly
right.
in front of the camera, Kaiser.
Right. Okay, I will. I'll twerk.
Long hair is very popular.
Long,
beautiful hair like yours, Kaiser, is very popular.
Yeah.
Well,
Kaiser's band did look for a shampoo sponsor for many years.
It's just a lie. That's a scurrilous lie. Now, I have tried not to be one of those people who talks about millennials, whether in China or in the United States. I don't like to roll my eyes when I do the eye rolling when I hear other people talking about millennials. There's always these damned articles constantly being written about, you know, millennials this and millennials that, how they're bringing about the end of the world. And, you know, because I remember people in the baby boom generation grousing about us, Generation X, people born in the 60s and the 70s, and blaming us for all manner of ills. And, you know, it's the same in China. It's, you know, 一代不如一代. And so people are always saying, oh, the next generation, this and that. And so I'm very suspicious of people my own generation, you know, people who say the same thing about the millennials. I think there's something kind of disingenuous about it. But Jiayang, you are a millennial yourself, right?
I'm the late end of a millennial, yes.
Okay. So, but I'm going to take what you say a little more seriously. So, well, I'm going to get you right this. Am I projecting, or do you also regard this whole phenomenon of abject of narcissism, of this runaway vanity as something deplorable, as horrible, as pathological, as symptomatic of something just like deeply wrong with the kids these days. I confess that I may be reading a little into what you've written, but I kind of couldn't help but suspect that you also hate them.
I think that's a great question. I'm glad you ask it because I think my piece can perhaps read that way, that I am, you know, passing very severe judgment on this generation, which I really don't mean to be doing. I mean, I do like my pieces to have a viewpoint. And a lot of times my hope is that through the documentary style of a long form piece, you see the facts as they accrue and the vantage point that I am shooting this verbal documentary from. But I also think that the Chinese millennials are responding to their circumstances and they're the products of a very specific time. And in a little bit, I'll get into how that's a little bit different, I think, from millennials here in the States. Uh-huh. But in China, you have just vertiginous development over the course of the past, you know, 3-4 decades. And in Chinese, you know, for the past century in China, everything has been a revolution. And you see the pendulum just swinging from, you know, one end to the other. And for Chinese youths, I think, they are responding to this cultural of materialism, you know, as you pointed out, that they've been steeped in, and also a certain sense of helplessness and lack of control. Mm. Whereas in the US, for many of our millennials, yes, you know, the economy hasn't looked great for many of us, and there are, you know, many, many flaws with our politicians. But there is at least some hope of voicing our discontent. You know, you might not make money from it, but there are other outlets, I think, for self-expression. Whereas in China, I think you have, you know, a generation of youth still very much steeped in the culture of collectivity, and you have them, you know, looking longingly at the, you know, flagrant materialism, and also feeling there's such a gap for so many of them between what they want for their lives and what they're able to achieve. And here I'm talking about kind of the very hierarchical nature of Chinese culture and Chinese politics, the sense that, you know, if you are not born into a certain echelon of privilege, it is not something that you can work yourself up to. And I think all of that really creates this crucible of hopelessness, but also reckless pragmatism. And what I mean by that is you feel, well, if there is no hope for me to achieve anything of worth through traditional avenues, and by traditional, I mean through schooling or through, you know, working really hard.
Getting a good job.
Right. Kind of the Hiroshi Alger model. Then what, you know, then how do I turn a quick buck? And then I think that leads you to the live streaming, to the internet reds, this very radical, but I think incredibly actually sensible way of making money and making sure that at least I am selling something and ensuring cash flow today, tomorrow, this week, if it's not. Even if, you know, I don't know when the good times will end.
Oh, that's interesting because it sounds like, you know, it's aspirational. It's kind of egalitarian, right? You can suddenly
right.
Everyone can be as beautiful as everyone else.
Right. I mean, I talk about this democratization of beauty and, you know, and May too with these, you know, what we could regard as rather bizarre, you know, just absurd seeming dystopian apps really does, you know, it says everyone, I mean, that's their motto. Everyone can be beautiful.
Huh.
Another factor that I think is relevant is the entertainment and media situation in China, where, I mean, you know, there's quite a lot of entertaining television now. It's different from the way it was 10 or 15 years ago. But still, everything is so stage managed and scripted.
Very much so.
Of course, on the TV, but even on the internet, you know,
yes.
You look at the news. It doesn't matter if you go to QQ News or Baidu News. Mm-hmm. Every day, it's the same stories. You know, mm-hmm. If you go to the central state media, it's the same stories.
Right.
this is one of the few media forms in China where the possibility of something really going wrong or unexpected happening exists. Do you think that might be some of the interest there?
I mean, yes. I mean, certainly, I think those tuning in for the firecrackers and the underwears hoping something will go, you know, a part of them, I mean.
I'm hoping something went wrong with the firecrackers.
Something went wrong before it even started.
Well, go catastrophically wrong. And recently, actually, just a few days ago, I don't know if you read this, but there was, I think, a daredevil high-rise climber.
What's his name? Yeah, right. The rooftop.
Young Mr. Wu, the rooftopper who died.
The rooftopper who died. And he think he was live streaming.
Yeah. So maybe we should just explain that word rooftop. Is young men daredevils. Usually who daredevils who climb to the top of skyscrapers
without safety nets
right. or ropes and take photos of themselves.
Right, and they can gain. I mean, and this is very much part of this culture that we're discussing. I mean, they can gain a very quick following, a massive following, very very quickly because I think people are attracted to kind of to the danger that they vicariously experience. And I think tragically, I don't know if this is true, but apparently he was he took on this particular challenge in order to earn $15,000 so that he could propose to his fiance
right.
and also help his, I think.
His mother was sick with the story.
Sounds typical. But no, I mean, this is not something new. I mean, the 1920s in America, it was just like this. I mean, there were all these barnstormers. There was, there were pole sitters. There were people
right.
who would just do all sorts of daredeviltry, people walking out on the wings of airplanes.
So, right, right. Was,
okay, so to get back to the narcissism, I mean, how widespread is this kind of narcissism we're talking about?
Or narcissism.
Is it limited to a vain and superficial fringe, or is this culture really going mainstream in mid-sized Chinese cities?
Yeah, I think the narcissism is interesting to unpack here because when we, you know, the term usually refers to you know, the picture I see in my head is just, you know, a person peering for hours at a time into a mirror, and it seems quite self-contained. But in China, I think this narcissism can pay. And I think that the economic dimension of the narcissism really is important to why it has become so much part of the culture. And also, I think it's less stigmatized than it is here in the US because it seems so prevalent in the culture. It seems like, you know, the selfie culture in China is uninhibited. It is almost glorious. Everyone posts daily selfies and it is not looked down upon. It just seems to be a way of letting the world know how you're doing. So I think in China, there is a recalibration in that sense. And it's also important to keep in mind that, you know, absent other moral
moorings,
right? Yeah. Moorings, controls. It's who is to say that this is something even to be stigmatized? Who am I harming when I'm posting about a dozen selfies of myself?
Right, and yeah, I must think that people in their parents' generation must find this abhorrent. So, I mean, I used to think I've lived in China, as you all probably know, for most of my adult life, and for the last 30 years, you know, hanging out with people my age, people who were born in the 60s or in the 70s, these people I always thought were, you know, had the biggest generation gap between them and their parents. But now I look at this generation underneath and think it must be even bigger. I mean, the kids I hung out with, sure, they had, you know, long hair and they wore blue jeans and listened to rock and roll, but they still took care of their parents and they worked hard and they went to school. They did all that stuff. And these kids, I mean, the people you profile, like Abner and Honey CC, do they represent maybe even a more radical break with tradition, or do they somehow fit into it as well?
Again, very good question. You know, I asked both Abner, who is this, just to give listeners a brief background, he's this 19-year-old in my piece. He is enrolled in college but doesn't go except for the exams. He sees his life as completely pinned to live streaming and being an internet celebrity and regards schooling as completely senseless. And I had a long conversation about his parents and how they see his life trajectory. And he said something that was, to me, deeply disturbing and saddening. He said, when I was growing up, my parents, his parents ran this mobile phone shop. He said that apparently was very time consuming. He said they spent all their time there at this mobile phone shop. They didn't really take care of me. I don't remember the last time they cooked me a meal. And all they've ever done is just nag. And what do I owe them, really? Hmm. You know, for all this talk of filial piety, what do I owe them? I don't think of them as having done their duty as parents.
Wow.
And that really struck me. I mean, with Honey CC, she comes from, her parents were divorced when she was very young. She didn't really see her dad very much. And her mom, I think, was just a homemaker. And, you know, she said that her mom was encouraging whatever she did that would make money for the family. So, so these, I think, older values, they are still in the culture of, you know, piety and of, you know, looking after the elderly. But the economic transformation has been such that the younger generation feels a different sense of obligation and responsibility to their elders, if that makes sense.
It's that brutal pragmatism that you talked about earlier.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And this sense that relationships between parents and child has become quite fractured, and I think, you know, they've become quite remote from each other. There isn't really as much, you know, they might live in the same household, but because of what they are all doing frantically to earn money, they're really not spending very much time together, you know, as in the olden days.
Right.
So I somehow imagine that Xi Jinping doesn't see beautification apps as a central part of the Chinese dream. But, I mean, more than that, one would think that this type of behavior would not sit that comfortably with a party that is, you know, quite puritanical and that for decades has been telling people to, you know, work hard, to be humble, not to be vain, not
right,
to spend money on, you know, consumer.
I think the party's relationship to what is going on in the youth culture is quite vexed and more complicated than we would think. Because on the one hand, when you have a regime like Xi Jinping's that is becoming more authoritarian, it feels like, you know, by the day, you do not want the youth to be channeling their discontent toward more political channels. You know, you want them to be satisfied enough that they are just, that they stay kind of, you know, within a certain segment of society.
So Mei Tu is the opium, the new opium of the masses.
I mean, that is one argument. And others, and I just want to kind of push back on my own argument there, and others have said, well, no, I mean, the youth, it's not even that they are deliberately kind of censoring themselves in any way or choosing, you know, the opium. It's that, I mean, part of it is also that they don't find politics just inherently interesting, that they're not even kind of...
Oh, that sounds right to me. I mean, most people who I meet in China are so absolutely uninterested in anything political. They would just rather you talk about anything but politics.
Right. Well, I think there's just the sense of it's so irrelevant to me. And I think the Chinese are exceedingly pragmatic in this sense. It's like, what can I relate to and what can help my life become better in measurable ways? And politics, I mean, you know, what is the human rights of other people? I mean, how does that affect me today, right now?
So what do they relate to? So what are the cultural touchstones for this? I mean, I've got to imagine there are things in the culture that are sort of the nuclei,
right,
around which these
right,
phenomena are congealing. So, like, you know, it's got to be like the Korean boy bands with all their kind of uniform appearance, that androgyny. That it's got to be like movies like Xiao Shidai, Tiny Times,
right?
I don't know if you've seen this, which is just sort of Sex in the City without any cleverness.
And, or sex.
Or sex.
Yes. And a lot of, you know, these like 100 episode TV dramas,
right,
that oftentimes show exceedingly attractive people leading very glamorous city lives.
Right.
And I think they do create an aspirational model that rarely do I really see a reflection of reality on TV or
unlike in America.
But I think, you know, there is I just don't ever see a movie like Moonlight. And I know that's for the U.S., you know,
that's
that was a triumph.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
In China, I don't see those social themes being grappled with in quite the same way.
You spend quite a bit of time with these Wang Hong, these internet celebrities. I mean, they are pretty ridiculous, but are they any more ridiculous than, you know, the Kardashians or our president or, you know?
Right. I think
that's a high bar.
I think the difference here, I mean, you're right. I think the Kardashians really are, I mean, they are kind of your proto Wang Hongs, your proto internet celebrities. But they are one channel that you can tune into, and they are a very powerful one, and it can feel like they've taken over all the, you know, celebrity magazines and, gossip channels. But in the U.S., at least it feels to me, if you, like, you know, the Kardashians fundamentally don't interest me, and I can go for days without having to kind of engage with them in any way. In China, I think it's almost like the pollution, if you can indulge me this metaphor. It just descends, you know, really kind of into your breathing space.
The Wang Hong culture.
Wang Hong
descends.
Right. I mean, it just feels like it's part of the fog of the culture, and you can't see the clouds. Like in China, I always lament you can't ever see a blue sky. I mean, at least in Beijing.
You can't ever go online and not be inundated in Wang Hong Bo.
Right. That there are some sense, especially, I mean, I think for the younger generation, I'm thinking for like the post-90s, for some of the post-80s, you know, if you are not part of that culture, if you're not worshiping kind of, or at least following closely the lives of Kardashian-esque characters, do you even exist? I mean, are you even participating in the cultural conversation? And this, and just one other thing I think that's interesting to point out is the celebrity worship in China really does, I think, take it to a new astronomical level. And I know, I mean, here in the U.S., you know, we have Us Weekly. We do have, you know, various,
tabloids and
tabloids. You know, I read them at checkout stands. I'm sure, you know, many people do. But in China, it feels, you know, when I talk to young people, it feels like there's a fundamental way in which their existence is just grafted onto celebrity culture.
Wow.
And to me, that's terrible. That's disturbing. I mean, you hear about, you know, young girls feeling suicidal when their idol, you know, has a girlfriend. And that is commonly reported. I mean, I don't know how many of them actually, you know, leap out of windows, but there is actually, you feel it, communal despair when idol, especially I think the idol, like a young male star, they're called 小鲜肉, like
yeah,
a little,
I like little fresh pieces of meat.
Little fresh pieces of meat. Exactly. They're like little soup dumplings.
Right.
When they pair up, the utter despondence of millions of, you know, young women, I mean, there's something very psychologically disturbing.
Lu Han has a girlfriend.
You know, yes, Lu Han is one
so,
of them.
I mean, you're talking to somebody who's got a 13-year-old daughter with a bedroom covered in Korean boy band posters. So I know what you see.
And I seem to recall your son said he wanted to become a YouTube star when
that's
he
right.
grows up. So.
Right. My son wants to be a YouTube celebrity. Which is like, you don't want to be a podcaster? Come on. What's wrong with dad's profession? Hey, but it is not all that dire, right? I mean, there are people like Papi Jiang, right? You guys, anyone know Papi Jiang?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, she's just like fantastically talented. And she's not. I think that she has completely resisted the blandishments of selfie beautification apps or of like frivolous live streaming. I mean, she does cutting, very funny, sharp social commentary and, I mean, satire. And she's very, very bright. So there's a lot of, I mean, there's other good bright spots out there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are, I mean, what I would like to encourage and what I'm encouraged by is a diversity in the ecosystem of live streamers. And Papi Jiang, when I do mention her name, you know, to live streamers, in China, they're like, oh, but she's so like 2015. 2015. She's so passe. But you're right, Kaiser, that her popularity is a testament, or, you know.
There are still people with reasonable taste.
Right. But all, yeah, right. That, you know, you can appeal on something other than.
So let's talk about Meitu's plans. I mean, I believe they want to expand abroad. Is that got any chance of succeeding?
When I talked to the CEO, his last name is Tsai, he told me that he hoped in 5 years, 80% of the world will be using Meitu and uploading their Meitu faces onto the internet. And that's 80% of the world population. I mean, that seems, well, you know, spectacularly ambitious to me. But they are very much looking overseas.
At the United States.
Well, I see
South.
One gigantic problem they're going to face when they try to expand into, for example, the United States. And you bring this up. I mean, it's very problematic. And that's the fact that there are race or at least class issues that are intrinsic to the assumptions that they build in to people's aesthetic preferences. One of the people that you talk to says, oh, no, it's already quite established that Chinese ideas of beauty are for fair skin and double eyelids and high nose bridges and, you know, all the things that you have. But I think that we've already seen instances where it will automatically lighten people. See, there are some beautiful women of color sitting in the audience here tonight.
Right.
And what would it do to their faces? I mean, that's
right. That is a question.
Have they been thinking about
this?
They
have been thinking about that. I mean, they're rolling out kind of the Euro-American wave and.
Because that's better.
Right. And that is according to, you know, Meitu staff and officials, that will bend toward more kind of naturalistic, you know, more nuanced Meitufication. But,
oh, is that Meitufication?
Meitufication.
Oh, my God.
But they also point out certain things, you know, certain parts of, Western Mandy. You know, one Meitu staffer was like, what's up with, you know, the American obsession with teeth, like white, straight white teeth? You know, in China, it's one of the, you know, even when they're fixing their photos, teeth whitening, you know, the Chinese would prefer having paler skin or to, you know, whiter teeth if they had to choose. But some Meitu folks are telling me that having white teeth in China, in the U.S. seems really...
The sine qua non, yeah.
Right. So, you know, they are sort of finding, they're picking kind of those points of vanity in our culture and not fixating as much on kind of, you know, the skin lightening. Though they tell me that, you know, if they can, you know, they're coming up with some bronzing apps, you know, the Americans are obsessed with their tanned physiques.
Look like Donald Trump.
Agent Orange. So one last question on the Meitu story before we move on to the other one, Jiayang. Can you tell us about your own consultation with a cosmetic surgeon and how that whole episode made you feel?
One of the more surreal episodes in my life, as someone with, I think, an ordinary, unexceptional amount of vanity, I sort of went in thinking.
Sorry.
As someone who I think is vain into an acceptable degree.
Okay.
I'd like to think. I went in there thinking that I would just be given a basic assessment of, you know, what tune-ups were needed. But it seemed like I went in there, you know, and they just wanted to kind of trash, like, the entire vehicle. That is, you know, they really, you know.
What was wrong with the vehicle?
They took chalk to your face. And I love that line you said. Yeah, I think it's just something like that after half an hour, your face looked like a military map after a long, involved
late stages
campaign.
Of battle. Yes.
The late stages of a battle.
Right. And I think the surgeon was very conscientiously just doing her duty. I mean, she really felt that for me to become truly beautiful, there needed to be a wholesale overhaul. And that was quite, and I would like to point out, I mean, you know, it was comical, you know, it is comical now, but in that moment, when you're in there and this doctor, you know, with years of medical training is telling you all the ways in which your face needs to be improved, I would like to emphasize that it kind of does shake you to your core. You think, you know, do I look like a gargoyle? Like, you know, am I, you know, have I been just walking around not knowing kind of the various...
I'm afraid so, dear.
The various ways that my life, you know, has been perhaps held back by, you know, my
well, you know why the little children run away when they see you now.
But that was really informative in that sense. And I can imagine how when you live in a culture where can be the surgeon, you know, not only the surgeon, but, you know, other, you know, your employers, you know, people who are interviewing you for jobs, your romantic prospects are all evaluating in that way. It can be incredibly, I think, toxic to your sense of self. And when I was there, she said, like, her starting estimate was like 30,000 for, like, you know,
yuan,
US dollars for, like, for me to become, you know, kind of minimally acceptable.
But think and how then quickly you could make that up as a long home, just, you know, the live
thinking,
streaming.
And then, you know, and then I walked out of there for a second just thinking, oh my God. And of course, I was in this plastic surgery hospital. They say they're not a clinic, that they're kind of a comprehensive hospital. And everyone there is preternaturally good looking. I mean, they do look like they walked out of magazines. And you're unsure whether that was by virtue of the surgeries that they've had, if they were born that way. And, you know,
born that way.
And there's a part of me that thought, wow, like, you know, if all these, you know, gates to my life can be opened by, you know, spending like $30,000, like, is that worth it? Like, and it does cast doubt that I think even non-Chinese are not impervious to.
Well, the way that this story connects to the other story that we want to talk about, at least in my mind, is through what both stories say about women and their status in contemporary China. What these stories say can't really, you know, be seen as good news for women either. I mean, you have infantilization and objectification and this fetish for youth and the overemphasis on beauty that we've been talking about, this rampant materialism we've been talking about. It's all very depressing. In this story that you published back in June, you wrote about these mistress dispellers, and you focused on this company called the Wei Qing Group and on a private detective. So tell us who they are and what it is that they do.
Right. In Shanghai last year, I visited this mistress dispelling agency. I mean, they're kind of a marriage consultancy / mistress dispelling agency. And they're in the business of saving marriages from partners that are sort of at their wits' end. And they use a variety of tactics to rescue these unions, some which may seem more bizarre to us than others. And one of the more extreme is, you know, seducing the mistress away from your philandering husband, either by attractive job prospect in another city, so you create distance, or maybe, you know, starting a rumor about the mistress that gets back to your husband, or in the case of the, you know, mistress dispeller that I interviewed, he visited the mistress and, you know, became friends with her, invited her to a possibly romantic weekend outing in another city, and then took these, you know, incriminating photographs with her, and then sent them back to the husband.
What happened to good old threat of physical violence? I mean, gosh. I'm calling old fashioned, but
I mean that is one of the tactics. But that is discouraged, not for any moral reasons, but because it gets a little messy.
It gets messy.
But yeah, it has, you know, it has become an industry in its own right in China, and an increasingly popular one, because marriages are not only about love and having, you know, a steady life partner, but about financial security in China. And you're sometimes saving these marriages not just so you can have a husband, but so that you can really secure, you know, your assets for the rest of your life.
So, I mean, how much does this the existence of this industry, what does it say about the state of marriage, of matrimony in China?
I think crisis is a word that comes to mind, but I think I fear that it gives readers the idea that it's something that's quite short term, when really, just like the culture, just like, you know, in my Mei Tu story, the history goes back much further. China is and has been a very patriarchal society. And up until the communist takeover in 49, marriages were primarily arranged by parents. So the idea of dating, of 自由恋爱, or free love, was a completely free love, meaning finding your own partner, you know, partner, is a completely alien concept. And in 51, when the first marriage law was enacted, that's when, at least on paper, you could choose your own partner. It was very much that. It was on paper. I think for a entire country of people to acquaint themselves with, you know, what it is to find your partner, to do this very strange, to involve themselves in this, you know, strange dance of dating. I mean, that is not something, that is not a decree that you can make.
Yeah, but I felt like by the early 1990s, say, there'd been progress. I mean, people really were sort of dating, and I mean, everyone was more or less equally impoverished anyway, and so it wasn't this nakedly transactional nature to marriage. I mean, it feels like it slipped back into it only later. And now, I mean, now I think we're at this point where, I mean, you mentioned in your story that they tell you secure the marriage to secure the assets and secure the assets to secure happiness. So, I mean, divorce, right? You'd think, why don't these men just leave their philandering husbands? I mean, but it seems to be foreclosed as an option to many women for basically economic reasons. So they can't divorce these awful cheating bastards because there are property laws that favor men, that most of the real estate is still held in the man's name. Is that, and yes. How is that allowed to persist?
Yes. I mean, I think that goes back to, again, the Confucian sense of patriarchy that's embedded in the culture that then becomes codified. Sometimes I think even unwittingly, because, you know, the communists, you know, Mao, for ever since China's quote unquote liberation, was all about women holding up half the sky. I mean, China for so long has been a country of sloganeering, and there's this sense that, you know, if I proclaim it, it will be so. But in an institution as complicated as marriage, and a culture where sexism has been ingrained for so long, it's very, very hard, I think, to only use laws to kind of arbitrate.
But I feel like there are a couple of legal fixes, though. I mean, one of them is this. It was only fairly recently that they passed this law that any property acquired by a man before marriage reverts to him in the case of divorce.
Right.
And then there's the other thing. It's like there's no spousal support. I mean, I was on my way over here. I was at a Lyft driver, Ralphie, 4.9 stars, really good guy from East Harlem. And he was telling me he is separated and, you know, he's grousing about the spousal support that he has to pay and the child support he has to pay. And, you know, he's a Lyft driver. I'm sure it is hard on him, but this is the right thing, right? I mean.
Right. And when I talk to lawyers, Chinese lawyers, they say that this is no spousal support and having assets revert back to whoever name it was held under before marriage is an act of gender equality. The thinking is that why should one spouse ever support the other, you know, after they are divorced, and they just go back to kind of separate entities, and they should be each be able to support themselves. And also, you know, in terms of the reversion of property rights back to the person who held the property before marriage, I mean, for the lawyer, you know, she said, well, that seems only right to me. I mean, it belonged to that person before marriage, it should belong to that person, you know, after marriage. But I think kind of intertwined in all of this is the, you know, traditions of the man buying the property before he can even begin looking for a wife. That kind of goes back, you know, millennia.
And the expectation on the part of a lot of women that
exactly.
This be so is perpetuating this problem. Then.
Exactly. Yeah. And that a lot of women will oftentimes give some of their own money to the man so that he can buy the property. And not lose face. I mean, losing face is a huge thing. And, you know, and China has not been a country of law for very long. So many of those transactions are made off paper, so they're not recorded. So, you know, then when you're married, you know, the apartment is wholly under your husband's name. And how do you go to a judge and say, oh, yeah, but like at 2 a.m., you know, the night before we decided, like, I was going to transfer all my money to him. I mean, that doesn't stand up in the court of law.
Jiayang, what's your sense of how socially acceptable sort of mistress culture has become in China? I mean, I'm just thinking of the last year I was in Beijing, I went to this fancy dinner hosted by the South African Embassy for South African China business people. And there were people from, you know, Golden Diamond Mines and South SAB Miller, the beer company. And then there were a bunch of Chinese companies, mostly state-owned, mostly involved in infrastructure and mining. And I mean, the table, I was sort of there sort of half working, and I got placed at a table with these guys from a steel company. And two of them had their wives who left just after the main course was served and were replaced by two young ladies who, you know, they were having quite a fine time with. And nobody, you know, bat an eyelid. And I mean, that's not the first time I've seen behavior like that. It certainly is a lot more acceptable than it would be in most parts of the United States. Do you think?
Yes.
How widespread is that?
I've been thinking about this a lot, actually, in recent days in lieu of the U.S. national conversation about sexual harassment assault. And I don't know if you guys read that very inflammatory article in the Global – was it Global Times or I think
China Daily. By the 60-year-old Canadian man who said there was no sexual harassment in China.
Right. Yeah. And you know,
I remember that.
The backlash was swift. But I was thinking how, again, the construct of the Chinese economy is such that, you know, if you know, when you take on jobs like being, you know, a coquettish internet celebrity, to if you voluntarily become, you know, a little third, a mistress as a woman, or one of these, you know, young ladies who kind of, you know, came to your table, you know. On the face of it, it feels like a choice, you know, that they've made. I mean, presumably nobody kind of handcuffed them and made them come. But the economic reality of China is such that if you're a young woman, you are taking stock of your own assets and you're thinking, well, how far can I get, you know, slaving away, you know, at a super competitive college if I'm able to get in? And, you know, what kind of jobs are going to be available to me? And how can I support myself and possibly, you know, my loved ones? Versus, you know, probably coming to a fancy dinner party if you're good looking and, you know, earning a really quick buck. And I think that, you know, that calculus is so important to understanding, you know, modern Chinese society, because, you know, whether it's my piece on May Too or my piece on Mistress Dispellers, they're not meant to, you know, invoke this kind of gawkery response where you're supposed to kind of point and finger the Chinese, say, you know, what are these weirdos doing? Why are they making such a bizarre, you know, choices that strip them of dignity? You right. have to look at the Chinese economy and what choices are available to, you know, to second class citizens. And I think women in this case, you know, clearly do not have many of the advantages of men.
Yeah, so there's kind of a generational issue here too, right? Because a lot of the women who are coming to these mistress dispellers seeking their services are maybe women of maybe my age, of women who are in their 40s or in their 50s, whose husbands are now cheating. And they're cheating with people who are millennials. These are those.
Right.
See, it's those damn millennials, those Joling Ho, the post-90s kids. And this is something that comes up in your piece. I can't remember which one it was who talks about them as being worldly and as
right.
being really just sort of
as worldly,
shrewd
and they think
competitive,
competitive, and they think of it as quite transactional. And you know, I was reminded of that interview when I was talking to these internet celebrities, these Joling Ho, these post 90s internet celebrities, and how kind of they very much, you know, they you know, exist in the same ecosystem in this sense. I mean, many of these you know, I was joking with you earlier that some of these internet celebrities that, you know, they might, you know, be moonlighting as mistresses. Their looks are assets, and how do you monetize that, you know, that asset? You have to have a certain kind of shrewd business acumen to know, you know, to turn it, because, you know, if you're a young woman, you know, you're a depreciating asset, you know, with every day that passes by. So how do you maximize your gain while you're able to? And I think that there is something generational that kind of ruthless desire to gain financial security when you're still able
to. I just don't buy the idea that it's baked into the Chinese character somehow, that pragmatism always takes such extreme forms. I just don't buy buy that. I don't think that has always been the case. It feels more recent to me. It feels like a slip that's only happened in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years.
Materialism has become more extreme than ever, right? Yeah. I mean, there's a real loss of mooring. There isn't, in traditional Chinese society, when you did spend more time with your family, unlike, you know, poor Abner, you might have felt like there were fallbacks, that, you know, you have a safety net of your family. But increasingly, I think the Chinese are become, you know, more alienated from that large web of family connections. And the only person you have to depend on is yourself. I think you're right. It's not like, you know, the post-90s. They're not a different species. I mean, they're not, you know, any weirder than any previous generations.
Sure, sure.
But I think there are economic realities that are being exerted, you know, that they're being affected by.
We're going to run out of time before questions, but maybe I can pose a final one.
Yeah,
you know, an American reader of your article, Mistress of Spellers, or perhaps listening to our conversation, is going to come away with a very grim picture of the state of gender relations in China. You know, sex, love, and marriage are essentially transactional. Marriage is mainly instrumental. Cheating is crazily rampant. And you don't even cover some of the other vices that China is rife with. But surely there are some bright spots in the institution of matrimony in China or not?
Bright spots in the institution of
matrimony. Anyway.
Matrimony. I do think that again and again, I hear about how committed parents are to their children. And I think that is both, you know, very Confucian and also quite modern. And I'm oftentimes touched by the kind of sacrifices that parents are willing to make so that the next generation can be brighter. And I think that is a source of hope.
Yeah, they can endure each other and all their horrible, like, their teeth grinding and their snoring and, and they're able to stay married just for the kids. Yay.
Right. And
what
also
a bright spot.
And also
that is a bright spot.
That is a bright spot.
All right.
A lot of people in this country don't seem to be able to stay married for the kids.
Yeah, this is true. Well, Jiayang, thanks so much. I mean, thanks, and also thanks to the great people, to Mary and Alan, who's here tonight. But thanks so much for the CKGSB for hosting us here tonight. Well, let's hear it for Jiayang. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And John, before we let you go, I mean, we want to make some recommendations. And before we do that, let me remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Subscribe to our free daily email newsletter for a roundup of the most important China news. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is SubChina News. And if you like the Seneca podcast, by all means, please go leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes store. Now, on to recommendations. And Jeremy, even though we should probably have ladies first, well, you know, it's our habit. You start.
I'd like to recommend buying a drone.
I
got a drone.
Got a drone.
I sold some Bitcoin and I bought a drone.
That's a sentence you couldn't have said before the year 2017.
No, I know. It's the only thing I like about 2017.
Sold some Bitcoin and bought a drone. Wow, that's such a
thing. So I would recommend buying the DJI Phantom 4 drone, which is under $1,000 and a really great camera.
Oh, that's the one they have at Costco, the $1,000 drone at Costco. Wow.
There we go.
Have you done anything with it?
Yes, I've flown it around Nashville.
All right.
I've made some really bad drone movies.
Has it encountered any unfortunate birds?
Not yet. What do they call it? A turkey vulture got interested in it one day, but it left it alone.
A turkey vulture. He's got turkey vultures there in his holler in Nashville.
Yep.
All right. Jiayang, you're up.
I was so encouraged by cooking for SubChina that I would just like to recommend, I think, an underrated condiment in Chinese cuisine. This came to me yesterday when at 2 a.m. I'm a night writer. I was very hungry and I discovered in my fridge a single Chinese cabbage, some scallions, and rice noodles. That was all I had. And I was like, how do I make a meal out of this? And I was feeling pretty down until, and I think the only thing I had was like salt.
It's like a North Chinese peasant in winter. Exactly. Right.
That's basically me at night, at 2 a.m. on any given night.
You got that tone, that my time.
I also ran out of black pepper. And, you know, as anyone who's ever heard me talk on anything, I mean, you know, a spice maniac, I discovered I had like some just leftover white pepper from God knows when. And white pepper is so incredibly, absolutely, I think, underrepresented.
It's soups. It's so great for soups. Yeah.
I really encourage all of you, you know, especially is, you know, we're in the midst of winter. If you want to make a hearty soup, include white pepper powder to your mix. It's a warning. It's a little spicier than black pepper.
Gets in the back of the throat.
It gets in the back of the throat. Right. But I think it's kind of fruitier. Internet tells me it's less complex, whatever that means. I think it's a lot more complex. You know, you've heard it from a part-time food critic. I really encourage you to kind of add
all
it.
Right. White pepper. Yeah, we were big white pepper users at the Guo household. So, yeah. Mr. Goldkmer. Okay, so I've got a couple of recommendations. One is a great piece in this week's New Yorkers by Gia Tolentino. Jiang, you know her, right?
I do.
Okay, so yeah. So it's about millennials, right? So as a millennial herself, as I said, you know, I cut them a little slack when writing about their own generation. She does a pretty good job, not just in skewering some of the more alarmist writing and silly moralizing that we're treated to constantly in the media, but also in identifying what is actually wrong with the damn kids. It's going to pair, I think, exceptionally well with, for those of you who haven't yet read Jiayang's piece, it'll pair well with that piece. It made me think a lot about the parallels in the U.S. and China between these post-90s in China and the millennials here. I also want to recommend a book that I picked up. It's great. I have a personal stake in the subject of this book. It's a book called Chinese Warlord, The Career of Feng Yuxiang. This book was written by a guy named James Sheridan, whose books I've recommended before, but Feng Yuxiang was known as the Christian general. He was a general in North China, also known as the betraying general, because he kept sort of flip-flopping in wars. But it happens that my maternal grandfather worked very closely with him as sort of a strategic advisor, kind of an internal diplomat, a diplomatic advisor to him. He's always been sort of among my favorite warlords. But what I really like about this book is that, you know, I just gotten through a couple of chapters, but in the introduction to it, he really lays he puts it in this historical context, and as you're reading it, you realize that in periods of fragmentation like this, in political when China is fragmented, whether it's in the Warring States period or in the Three Kingdoms or maybe in the Five Dynasties period and Ten Kingdoms, you see these features of the Chinese political culture sort of emerge in kind of the naked essence of them. I don't mean to sound too essentialistic here, but these are definitely recognizable features of Chinese politics. And Lucien Pai actually wrote about this in a book that he wrote about warlord politics. But the warlord period is really undervisited, I think, and people don't really understand it, because first of all, it's just so damn complicated. There's just so much to keep straight. But this book does a really admirable job. It's extremely lucid, very, very well written, very entertaining. And Feng Yuxiang himself is quite a character, as you'll see, known for having baptized his troops with a fire hose before sending them into battle. Anyway, thank you once again to the great people here at CKGSB for hosting us. And thanks again to Jiayang. And I hope you've enjoyed it. And we'll take your questions after a hearty round of applause for Jiayang and for CKGSB. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/subchinanews. And, of course, follow us on Twitter @subchinanews. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.